And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
Most of my podcasts are recorded sitting in my office on Bainbridge Island, where I have a wonderful view of some beautiful evergreens and Puget Sound. It's a lovely place. But today, my wife and I and some friends are in Sun Valley, and so I'm looking out at some amazing blue sky and beautiful, beautiful mountains and a crisp fall afternoon, and we are here for the running of the sheep. So I'm here to have fun in Sun Valley, but I've still got some serious topics here for this podcast that I hope will give you a better perspective of the investment process. And I want to, I've got a number of topics, but this first topic is about the performance for the first 9 months of 2017. I think there are some interesting lessons here. And so I'm going to take what is a very short period of time and talk about what happened for this nine-month period, compare different asset classes, compare the results of, and I'm going to focus on one of the portfolios, the best-in-class portfolio for the ultimate buy-and-hold portfolio, which is this combination of very large and small and U.S. and international and value and growth. So it's not overweighted to any one asset class. But there are things I think of interest here in this first 9 months. And let me just go through some of these things that caught my attention. First of all, it has been an amazing 9 months for most asset classes. And if I try to go back and recreate my thoughts at the first of the year, I really would not have predicted that the internationals would come out of the starting gate and, well, not immediately take the lead, but by the end of 9 months, the results of the international asset classes were two and even almost three times the return of the U.S. Similar asset classes. I might have expected, because we've had so many good years for small cap value, that this would be another good year for small cap value. And while it wasn't a disaster in terms of the actual return, it was certainly not what people expected in the U.S. market. But the international markets, some big payoff for small cap value. So let me approach this in a little different way than I have in the past. What I'll do is look at each asset class, because the best-in-class recommended portfolio has at least one fund in each asset class here. So let's look then at the average return for a particular asset class. And then let's compare that to how the ETF that we recommended did. So for example, the average large cap blend was up 12.7%, whereas the Vanguard S&P 500 ETF, VOO, and I won't give the symbol on each one, was up 13.6%. So that's advantage to the best in class. Then when I look at the large cap value average return, it was 9.2, whereas the Vanguard Russell 1000 Value Index was up 7.7. Advantage, average ETF. Then the Vanguard S&P Small Cap 600 Index, that's simply a small cap blend, was up 8.9 versus the average of 8.2. Advantage, the best in class. Then we have the Small Cap Value. There, the average was up 4.8%, but our recommended small cap value ETF was down 3.1%. Now, let me just stop right there, because now we have a significant difference between what the average in that asset class did versus the one that we selected. And what went wrong? Well, I could say nothing went wrong, and you'd say, are you crazy? No, but here's what we know about this small cap value ETF that we recommend. It has a very small company size, deeply discounted. And as we look back at the year-to-year returns, you'll see wide variances between what the average does in that category and what this particular one does in that category, because it is more deeply discounted. And the companies are definitely small. And a conversation that Chris Pederson and I have had is, can our investors take it? And I don't mean that as a challenge to your personhood. I simply mean that it may be hard for people to see such big differences between what we recommend and what the average in that particular category does. Because we certainly, by being less aggressive, certainly on the short term, we could say that we would have been able to be closer to that average if we had had a more average size ETF that we recommended in terms of size of company and how deeply discounted. And that's a conversation that's going to be ongoing for us, because remember, success with investing first and foremost, I mean, it's got to make sense, whatever it is that you're doing. There's got to be some evidence that a particular strategy has a long history of success. But if on the short run, the lack of success is too unsettling to somebody and they give up on it, and sometimes at the very worst of times, then we've got to think carefully. Do we want to be more average in the hopes of keeping you committed to the long-term strategy? So we'll have more on that in the coming months, I know. Let's move on to the REIT. The average REIT, these are the average of the ETFs, up 4% versus the Vanguard REIT ETF, up 3.2%. So advantage to the average. Then the next one is the developed markets. That's large cap blend internationally. The average was 19.7 versus the Vanguard Developed Markets ETF, up 21.2, advantage best in class. Then we have the large cap international value. The average was up 17.5, and the best in class, which we selected as the MSCI EFA Value Index, was up 19%. Then the small cap blend internationally, average up 24.6 versus our selection up 23.8, advantage the average. Then we have the WisdomTree. Well, first of all, the asset class is international small cap value, which the average was up 91.4. And our choice, the WisdomTree International Small Cap Dividend Value ETF, up 25. So advantage to the best in class. Then we have the emerging markets. This is the large emerging markets, what I would call a blend, but larger companies, a blend of growth and value. But the average was up 25.1, and our choice, Vanguard Emerging Markets ETF, up 23, advantage the average. Then we have an emerging market small cap. Now, that is going to be compared. They don't have a small cap average for emerging markets. So you have the same 25.1 and the emerging market small cap was up 25.2. Small, very small advantage to the best in class. And finally, we have the global REIT. This is without the U.S., so it's an international REIT asset class. The average was 16.7, and the one that we selected was 20.8, a big advantage to the one that we selected. Now, here's the lesson. As I look at all of the average and all of the best in class, what I find out is overall, the average was a gain of 15.6 for the first 9 months. And the average for all of our portfolios was 15.7. So you could say, you know, big deal. What have you done for me lately? And here's what we have to understand, that 1 year at a time, you should not expect whether it's an index to outperform the actives all the time. About 60%, the benchmark wins, and the actives, the other 40% are able to do better. Now, that's a little, not quite exactly apples to apples, because what we're investing in the best of class is not the index, but the index, some index, less expenses. And when you look at the S&P, what they call the SPIVA report, that does not include any expenses in the benchmark. So we're being held to a tougher standard. But what we do know about the SPIVA report is as you get out to longer and longer periods, in most cases, most asset classes, that the index approach is going to do better than the actively managed. But because our index approach is net of fees, we don't have the full advantage of being able to compete without fees. So we have to be realistic about what we'll be able to do. But we do know on a short-term basis, the active group has a pretty good shot at doing better than the passive. And in this particular case, we barely were able to do better. But I will tell you what I think is a more interesting comparison here, because remember what this best in class is attempting to do. We are trying to look, and Chris Pederson has done most of the research on this in terms of ferreting out the best that we would want to be in every asset class in terms of picking an ETF for somebody who wants to go anywhere in the industry to build a portfolio. So what do we know about Vanguard versus the best in class? Now, here's what we know about Vanguard. Vanguard does not have an ETF for every asset class we're trying to have in this portfolio. I do know if you had invested in the Vanguard only commission-free portfolio that we recommend at our website, that the return for the average of all of those particular asset classes at Vanguard was 14.8 versus the best in class of 15.7. Now that 9 months does not a lifetime make, but that's our goal. Our goal is to be able to get you access as we can best find it for all of the asset classes that we think you should have in the equity part. Now, you might be, this is looking at, in essence, 100% equity, but the equity part of your portfolio, we want to show you how to do the best that we know that you can with a broadly diversified portfolio. Now, without getting deep into the woods, you can see that if you had had a value-only portfolio, you would have been left with about a 7.7% return in U.S. large value. You would have had a minus 3.1 in U.S. small value. You would have had a plus 19% for international large value. You would have had a 25% return in international small cap value and a 2% return in that emerging markets part of the portfolio. That would have been the impact of an all value, and you would have had that big sore thumb sticking out there of a minus 3.1 that kept it from being a huge home run. So that's kind of a look back at the last 9 months, and again, 9 months we know is not what we can count on for the rest of our life, but it was good to see that everything we picked was within a good range, a tight range of what you should have gotten for those asset classes, with the exception, again, of that sore thumb that we're going to be talking more about in the future, that U.S. small cap value asset class. Now, I could drone on and on about performance, and I know there's only so much you can take, but I do want to focus on one more return area that I've had a lot of questions about, and that is what we call the Vanguard Monthly Income Portfolio. The purpose of this particular portfolio is really meant for people who do not want any equities but are looking for some sort of a balanced way to address a fixed income portfolio. And I know when we started 2017, we were certainly not expecting the fixed income securities to do well. And in fact, we finished the equity performance of 2016 very strongly. And so it would not have surprised us if bonds had a difficult year in 2017. So far this year, it's interesting to look at the four funds that we recommend, and we've been recommending these for, gee, it must be almost 20 years now. But the short-term corporate bond index at Vanguard, up 2.5 for the first 9 months. The intermediate-term corporate bond index, up 5%. The Ginnie Mae up 1.9, and the high yield up about 7%. Now, we recommend 25% in each, which would have been about a 4.1% return for the first 9 months. Now, people are still sitting around waiting for bonds to go down as interest rates go up, but that is what we experienced for the first 9 months of this year. Now I want to change gears and address one of the biggest challenges that investors face today. And that is the investor that is still sitting on a pile of cash trying to figure out what to do. And as you know, our industry, regardless of what's been happening lately, is going to have an answer for what you should be doing with your money, because their job is to get your money to work now. And I was struck by an advertisement I saw on a CNBC website, and what they were promoting was a show that you should be tuning into, because on that show, they were going to address what you can buy now to get back in the saddle. Get back in the saddle, get back in the market, what you can invest in now through the end of the year. Now, that, first of all, boy, anybody who talks about where you can put your money for the next 3 months is not talking about investing, they're talking about speculating. And they're not talking about knowing anything about you. I mean, this is one of the challenges of the whole, whether it's me blabbing on and on here about what you should be doing, or somebody who's on TV or in a magazine, in an article, wherever you look, you're gonna read people telling you what to do. But the first thing is, they don't know anything about you. So their advice may be good for a certain group of people, but terrible for another. And for the people who listen to our podcast, read our articles, watch our videos, I hope that you're looking there for information on how to invest for the long term. But it still doesn't change the reality that people sitting on cash are still struggling with how to get invested. Hopefully not for the next 3 months, but for the next 30 years or the next 10 years or a period of time that suggests that it's okay to take some risk for a part of your portfolio. So I would hugely applaud somebody who says, well, whatever you do, make sure you do it and you get rock bottom low expenses. Whatever you do, I want you to do it in index funds where you're not relying on any one company or any one industry or any one country to make your financial future successful. Whatever you do, I hope you do it in a tax efficient way. Whatever you do, I hope you do it within your your risk tolerance. So those are the things that should be telling you to do, but then we should also be telling you, whatever you do, don't listen to us until somebody or you have looked very carefully at who you are as an investor and what your needs are for the long term. Because most of what you hear in terms of recommendations are really based on very short periods of historical evidence. Anybody tries to sell you a fund based on the last 10 years and how wonderful that is going to be in the future, they know they're fooling with you. They know they're playing with your emotions because they know that a 10-year period is statistically not important at all. So, when you hear somebody saying you got to go watch a show because they're going to tell you what to do for the next 3 months, you know, if that's a phone call, hang up. If it's a TV show, turn it off. Another question that I get often with slight variances has to do with how to handle cash. But this one's a little different, and I think it probably does apply to a number of our listeners. This particular email says, could you please discuss the role of cash in a portfolio? Besides our yearly spending distribution that feeds into a money market account in January, should we have an additional rainy day account or should we plan to use our portfolio? But first, let me talk about that money that you're putting into your annual spending account. My wife and I do the same thing, but I will note that we do not put that money into a money market account. We put it into a short-term bond fund. Now, what's the risk and what's the return? Well, I'm not thinking about the risk 1 year at a time, and I'll address that in just a second. So we're willing to take a little bit of risk going into a short-term bond fund where we could lose a percent or two. As a matter of fact, there's 1 year in the last, I think, 25 that you would have actually lost at Vanguard 4% in that fund. On the other hand, I think that we will make as much as a percent and a half to possibly a 2% better each year. But even if it were an extra half to 1.5% a year, I would be willing to take that risk in the short-term corporate bond fund at Vanguard. Now, then the question is, what about how much of an emergency fund should you have above and beyond that Or should you simply look to your portfolio as that emergency fund? Well, what my wife and I have done is we've looked at our portfolio, our long-term portfolio, as what we could do in case of emergency, because we have half of our money in bonds. And a part of that is in short-term bonds. Part of it's in intermediate-term bonds. But the bottom line is that we know that we got, and I should also add, that those bonds are mostly, certainly in the IRA, they're in government issues. In the taxable part, they're also in government issues, basically, but they're municipal bonds. The thing is, we see that 50% of our portfolio as accessible if we really had a short-term emergency. So that would be my approach. On the other hand, what I find a lot of people do is when they take that money out for the year, they take out more than they need. And they just have that as a cushion for some unexpected. Now, an unexpected need is not necessarily an emergency. It may be a good short-term need because you've decided to do something fun in life or to give it away to a child or something. So that's an important decision. Again, I think if you leave that money in the portfolio, the so-called retirement portfolio, and don't look at it specifically as an emergency fund, but know that a big part of that portfolio is easily accessible, that you will receive a reasonable premium for taking that risk. Remember, the rule that we have is we never take a risk for which we do not expect a premium. Another question that I often receive has to do with kind of what happens if everybody indexes, or another way that they'll address it is what will happen to active management if everybody goes into low-cost mutual funds that don't pay a big premium to the active managers anymore like they used to. And it came to mind particularly when I saw a recent table that showed since 2005 what has happened to mutual funds that do not have loads and do not have 12b1 fees. And what they are saying, first of all, is that this year it is expected that more than 80%, in fact, they're saying 85% of new sales are going to go into no-load funds without a 12b1 fee. And it's going to, that direction is going to continue to go, I think, that way, because there is this big movement afoot where load funds are coming out with issues, securities of the same fund, but basically without a load in them, but some sort of commission being charged by a broker that is servicing that account. So again, you know, we have John Bogle to thank for this. It all started there with not only indexing, but the low fees that kept putting pressure on management companies to lower their fees. And then on top of that, the academic community comes out and says that everything says if you get lower fees, you get a better return. Probably, not always, probably, highly probable. But that has driven a ton of money to no-load funds and funds without any 12b1 fees. So back in 2005, it was 59% of purchases were with no-load funds and without 12b1 fees. And by 2010, it slowly climbed up to 68%, and by 2015, up to 79%, and then 81% in 2016, and now predicting 85% for 2017. So the tipping point was reached some time ago. And more investors, even those that aren't very savvy, are getting the message. But what about, what is going to happen to these active managers who are having to compete not only with mutual funds, open-ended mutual funds, but also ETFs with very low expenses? Well, I think what's happening, and I'm not feeling sorry for them because they have cut a very fat hog for a very long period of time, those people who have charged very high fees for active management and have been able to not only charge high fees, but not lower them as they accumulated billions and billions of dollars. So the same thing that has happened to, as we know, since the 80s, when most Americans for the next 30 plus years did not get any kind of a raise, it looks to me like for a very long period of time, active managers are just going to have to take a cut in pay. And they'll still do just fine. I'd like to address, and I've addressed this before, a question here from a listener who is asking about the choice between a couple of different Vanguard funds. One is VIOV, and the other is VBR. Now, these are small-cap funds. They are value-oriented small-cap funds. And remember, I talked last week about the study that was done by Dr. Israelson about the difference in different kinds of indexes in small growth and value, in mid-cap growth and value, and in large-cap growth and value. And what we found is there was a big difference in return between the Morningstar Index and the Russell Index and the S&P Index. And we also talked a little bit about the way that DFA constructs their index. But I think that what would be a natural reason for people to choose a VBR over VIOV is because VBR has a much lower expense ratio, 0.07 versus 0.20. And we are taught low expenses lead to higher returns. Now, let me take a radical comparison. Think about if you had to pay 20 basis points to own a S&P 500 fund versus 7 basis points to own a bond fund, which would you probably pick for the long term? Well, as we look backwards, let's say almost 90 years, we know that stocks make about twice as much, about 5% more per year than bonds. So I think it would be hurting yourself if you chose the lower expense fund, the 7 basis points versus the 20 basis points, because you would be choosing an asset class that is expected to perform with a lower return. By the way, 1 basis point is the equivalent to 1/100th of 1%. So 10 basis points would be 1/10th of 1%, 20 basis points would be 2/10ths of 1%. So now let's get back to this comparison of VIOV versus VBR. So big advantage to VBR. On the other hand, if we look at the average size company, VBR is about twice, in fact, more than twice the size as VIOV. So now what do we know about smaller companies? Well, smaller companies are supposed to make a higher rate of return than larger companies. That's at least what we know for the very long term. And that is true whether you're looking at smaller large companies versus larger large companies, or smaller small companies versus bigger small companies. So that advantage should go in the long term to VIOV. Now, if you look at VIOV, about 41% of the portfolio is actually in small cap value, and about 1% is actually in mid cap, larger companies. Now, that shouldn't surprise you, because you know that VIOV has an average size company that's smaller, but to look at it a slightly different way, at VBR, 33% of the portfolio is small cap value, but 36% of the portfolio is mid cap. And by the way, that's mid cap blend, mid cap growth, and mid cap valued in total. Then, if we look at the number of stocks, VBR has almost twice as many stocks as VIOV. Well, you know, that's in theory advantage to VBR. But the fact that VBR has a much bigger average size still gives the advantage to VIOV. VIOV also has higher turnover than VBR. That would be an advantage to VBR. If we look at the return for the last 5 years, VBR has compounded at 14.7 and VIOV at 15. So an advantage of about a quarter of 1%. But what do we know about the last 15 years? Well, here's where you've got a problem. We don't have a 15-year return for these two funds or ETFs. But what we do have is we can look at the 15-year return of the small cap value mutual fund versus the S&P 500 versus the DFA small cap value index, which, by the way, the DFA small cap value index would be much more like VIOV than VBR because of the size of the companies. But what we know about the last 15 years is that the small cap value, which basically is the same as VBR, had an 11.3% compound rate of return versus the DFA fund of 12.2%. And so advantage for a very long period of time has gone to the DFA fund. What do we know about the future? You know, we don't. We don't know whether the small cap advantage will hold up. We don't know whether the value will hold up. But based on the size of companies, based on how deeply discounted they might be, my feeling is, and oh, I didn't mention this, this is important, VBR, the relationship between the price to book, has a 1.8 price to book ratio as opposed to a 1.6 price to book ratio for VIOV. If it's only a quarter of a percent advantage to VIOV over VBR, so be it. Any advantage, I think, will be to your advantage for the long term. Is the risk substantially greater with VIOV versus VBR? Well, what we know about almost 90 years of performance is the difference between small cap blend and small cap value is very similar on the downside. In fact, if you remember from the study, that we showed you about the small cap value versus small cap blend, the worst periods were about the same. Well, my wife just came in the room. It's time for breakfast. And then we go out for a walk into the hills around Sun Valley. I hope your life is as wonderful as ours, and I really do appreciate you taking the time to share with me. I am so appreciative of the notes and emails that you all have sent in appreciation, but believe me, I appreciate that you're there so that I may be able to help you. Thanks for listening.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.